Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is there a difference between good diseases and bad ones? The same culture that celebrates the brave fight of those diagnosed with breast or brain cancer tends to blame the patients whose tumors take hold in their lungs. People with type 2 diabetes, which can be linked to lifestyle, tend to engender less empathy than those with type 1. Media coverage of Ebola has portrayed some of the people infected as heroes, while others are the objects of scorn and revulsion. And for centuries, outbreaks of infectious disease have often been blamed on immigrants, the poor, or the allegedly immoral. So why do we deem some sick people worthy of our attention and support while others are judged to somehow deserve their suffering? My guests are here to talk about some of these questions. Dr. Robert Kugelman is professor of psychology at the University of Dallas. Dr. Angelica Tratter is adjunct professor of psychology at the University of Dallas. Welcome both of you to Think.
Thank you.
Welcome.
First of all, how much does society's attitude about a disease affect a patient's individual ability to cope with it?
Quite a bit, I would think. Our diseases are not simply bodily things. They're also social events. You know, we live with a disease. We have social relationships with others because of our disease with doctors, but also with family and friends. It may influence work relationships and so on. So they're very much interpersonal social kinds of experiences for people.
Yes, very much so. And actually, it's quite amazing how it also changes over time. Like we started out, you know, in the history with burning witches for mental disorders and really taking very much a moral tack toward it. And now there's a sea change in the last decades where everything is being approached like from a disease model. Whatever people do is kind of not their fault because they have this disease. And this has been quite for a while like this. But now we have, again, a little bit of moving back toward looking at persons as moral agents that actually can make changes. And so there is really quite an effort in bringing choice and individual responsibility back into the picture, but without going back to the blame model. So we really have quite some cultural evolution there, don't we?
Yeah, we do. I mean, when diseases were primarily infectious diseases, I think it was different. And then sometime in the 20th century, chronic diseases became more prevalent and sources of illness and death as some of the infectious diseases were controlled. And for a while, it was the case that, you know, modern medicine as it developed, in a sense, took the morality away from disease.
Right.
You know, it was a bacteria or it was something wrong with your physiology and so on. But in recent decades, psychological and behavioral components have returned with our understanding. So, for example, risk factors associated with diabetes or heart condition, et cetera, do play a role. And there's a temptation to remoralize some diseases.
Right. What's interesting is that doesn't necessarily make room for the fact that some people who have a terrible lifestyle, at least as compared with what doctors would recommend,
right,
never get sick. And then other people, you know, who may or may not take good care of themselves, and I'm using air quotes there, do in fact get sick. But we feel like we can tell the difference somehow when
right,
we meet someone.
Right. Yeah. There's a social psychologists talk about the fundamental attribution error, namely that we have a tendency, especially in our very individualistic society, to locate the cause of behavior in the individual, in their disposition, rather than in circumstances or their situation. And so because of that, if someone gets sick and we can assign a blame to them, there's a tendency to do that. For example, a personal story, my father died of lung cancer. And oftentimes the first question I get after I tell people that is, oh, was he a smoker?
Mm-hmm. And as if to say, well, then shame on him if he,
absolutely,
if he was.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. And, you know, it ignores other factors like working in New York City and traveling through the refinery districts of New Jersey every day on his way to work and so on. And God knows what else contributed to the disease.
Yes, and for an individual, it is always totally perplexing to try to orient themselves between the gene and the environment, because both influence quite a bit. So, like in client populations, we do see very frequently individuals who do everything wrong by the book. I mean, living it out shamelessly, so to speak, making all the possible mistakes one can make, and still being rugged and healthy like a horse. And then others tend to themselves very cautiously, but still have certain genetic liabilities. So we really have the whole spectrum here, from the societal environmental factors to contend with, as Bob has just outlined, to then the genetic limitations that we do have that can also put their fingerprint on our lives.
So as you've both described, in our past, there was kind of a moralistic framework for evaluating people who got sick, and then it was sort of Calvinistic, right? That if you had offended God in some way, you were going to get sick.
Right.
Today we do it based more, it's seemingly on science, but there's still a sense that someone has done something that caused their illness. Are we as a society, do we tend to do this as a way to comfort ourselves and say, well, I'm living okay, so this is not going to happen to me?
That's part of it. I mean, I think part of the our situation is that health has become one of the most important values or virtues a person can have. And it's a way of, for many of us, it's a way of proving ourselves as good people.
Self-disciplined people.
Self-discipline. Mm-hmm. You know, we say that things are bad for us, you know, things that are fattening or whatever. We use moral terminology in describing health and illness. So there's a tendency to see illness as something that is bad and then something that is wrong with you. You know, you say, what's wrong with you?
And then there are certain illnesses that engender much more sympathy and compassion, particularly among, let's say, among women, a woman who has breast cancer or any other cancer of the reproductive organs, there usually we find an immediate sense of sympathy and compassion simply because we do not know any moral causes of what that individual could have done wrong. Not like with lung cancer, as Bob has just illustrated, where you think of, oh, smoking behavior. There's nothing one can think of what a person might have done wrong with breast cancer. And so people do find it easier to be empathetic and reach out to those individuals and don't judge them so much.
What's really interesting is I looked online at like the most common cancers for women, and it's breast cancer, lung cancer, and colorectal cancer. Mm-hmm. And there are not parades for colorectal cancer, even though people are suffering just as much. Is there something about, is that because breast cancer really just became the target of this awareness campaign, which mm-hmm. now everybody's aware of it, but the campaign continues. And so what we have left is to show that we're in the corner of people who are suffering.
Well, we could wonder whether colorectal cancer has some sort of yucky connotation or something to it. It's a very good question. I've really never thought about that. Yes, there isn't a support group there. And certainly not because it's blaming, but perhaps because we just didn't get there yet. It may still come.
Yeah, one of the things that is interesting about our ability to empathize with people with illness is the visibility of the illness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of it with some forms of cancer, like breast cancer. It threatens someone's appearance, perhaps. And I know I saw one study where people that had visible signs of cancer, like, for example, some forms of melanoma or something, were less likely to be seen as someone that you would want to help than someone whose cancer may have cancer, but it's not visible to you. So the visibility of some diseases make them much more likely to be viewed as stigmatizing. And whereas, on the other hand, you have people with suffering from chronic pain who, because it doesn't show, can be stigmatized as lazy or as faking it and so on, even though they're indeed suffering from pain.
The other thing that's fascinating to me is this narrative we have that people, particularly with cancer, and there are lots of other diseases that we could probably slip in here, but that they not only can fight their disease, and that's always the language that we have, you know, battle with cancer, but they have the power to fight their disease. And on the one hand, it sounds really empowering for the patient. On the other hand, it puts a lot of responsibility on their shoulders and, you know, God forbid they fail to get better.
They fail to fight, yeah. There's a lot of banking now into alternative nutrition and lifestyle. So people who get a cancer diagnosis may start to walk every day, may start to no more eat any inflammatory foods, but just stick to kale and broccoli and the sorts, and really feel empowered, feeling like they're doing the best they can in terms of coming back to the question of the moral agent who has or can take responsibility for their lives. So really gearing up and trying to do the best they can. But yes, where does that leave others who listen to the medical community where the dictum is still nutrition doesn't really help? I mean, it's very controversial. Nothing is very much substantiated. So that leaves the general public very much at a loss in terms of what they should do. Should they become like radical believers into all these alternative nutrients and foods, or should they just trust the chemotherapy, and that's that. So it really puts the consumer in a difficult position.
Yeah. Plus, you know, there's a fairly long tradition in our culture of a belief that individual initiative can accomplish anything. I once looked back at the uses of the term willpower, going back to the 1850s. And this notion that with willpower, you can have the resolve to overcome anything, is pretty deeply ingrained. And coupled with that, there's a belief system that if you're ill, it's because of the way you're thinking. So if you think the right thoughts, if you have what's called a fighting spirit, you should be able to overcome anything. And while there's some truth to that notion of that fighting is good, on the other hand, if you get stuck in that model, then we're all doomed to fail. We're going to lose the war. So it's something that comes and goes. But it recently had quite a widespread circulation with New Age. But even in psychology and some forms of medicine, you know, you want to empower people, but at the same time, you don't want to give them false hope.
Right. And it's also very much a cultural phenomenon. It's very much germane to the United States, this rugged optimism. There's actually a name for it, strategic optimism, versus some other cultures practice more defensive pessimism, being geared and ready for the worst to happen, so I'm ready for it. But strategically optimistic is really the way that this culture chooses to live.
We're speaking this hour with psychologist Dr. Angelica Tratter and Dr. Robert Kugelman from the University of Texas at Dallas about the psychology and sociology of illness and the way we frame it. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking about society's responses to illness with two guests from the University of Dallas. Forgive my error earlier. Both are psychologists, Dr. Robert Kugelman and Dr. Angelica Tratter. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. You can also send email to tweet me at Chris Boyd. Think. So let's talk about the way that illness can define people and affect their identity. You can go along throughout your life feeling like one sort of person, and then suddenly, if you have an illness that is, particularly one that is very debilitating or very visible to other people around you, suddenly that is a thing that defines you. Can you talk about some of the ways that people have to cope with this and come to grips with it?
Yeah, one of the things that health psychologists and health sociologists study are narratives of illness. Mm-hmm. And there's even been a typology or two developed of narratives of illness. And one of the key concepts is the notion of biographical disruption. In other words, you're going along with your life and you have an implicit or explicit idea of where you're going and so on and so forth. And all of a sudden, you have a stroke, you have a heart attack, you break a leg, whatever it is. And your life is somehow disrupted. Now, it can't be automatically assumed that even a serious illness is a disruption, but it can be. Although I saw one study in which elderly people had strokes, and they did not find it as disruptive because they saw it as that's one of the things that happens when you get old. But there is. You know, part of the way we understand ourselves is by the way we tell our stories about ourselves to ourselves and to others. And so the notion of an illness narrative is one of the ways in which we define who we are, what's happened, where it's going, perhaps, and so on.
I think the more we are personally invested in an identity image, that's really important for us, particularly if it's even, let's say, narcissistically overemphasized, a narcissistic dependency on that image, the more it'll be a disruption. And very often, that's the benefit for older people, as Bob has just mentioned, where when we come to grips with having had a life, moving more in a gratefulness position for what it is we already all had, and realizing that it'll come kind of toward the end, and then having one or another change, even if it's a major change in the form of an illness in one's life, then is sort of less disruptive. We can cope with it better. And that seems to be useful for the adult life cycle for it to play out that way. But for younger people, it can be a serious assault onto their identity to have to deal with a major illness.
There's a big difference in the way communities come together around people who have major illnesses, depending on when it happens in their life, right? If you hear that someone has been stricken with a serious illness and they're in their early 80s, you might, feel sorry for them or be concerned about them, but it's not quite the same as if the exact same illness strikes mm-hmm. someone who is 50.
Right.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of things that come into this, you know, an age of the person who's getting sick, their location within the family and the community makes a big difference. Because we have individual and collective ideas of how life should be. And, you know, and one of the things that's changed in terms of our life expectations is that we assume we're all going to grow up and live a long life and die when we're nice and old. And it used to not be that way. I remember seeing a graveyard in Indiana in which there was a series of graves of children of different ages that who all died within a few weeks of each other, like back in the 1840s, mm-hmm. because probably some epidemic swept through the community. And that was not uncommon. But now, you know, we assume we're all going to have a kind of standardized life cycle. So if an illness breaks in when you're 20 or 30 or even 50, it seems like something that should not happen.
Right, that nobody's ready for, right?
No one's ready for it.
Right.
Occasionally it happens that someone has been coping with a really serious illness that suddenly becomes manageable. And I think about people who sort of midway through our knowledge of HIV/AIDS suddenly discovered themselves in a position to be not cured, but to manage their illness with medication if they had access to health care. That's got to be an interesting shift as well, to go from thinking of yourself as someone who is sort of actively dying to thinking, I might have decades of my life left to live.
Mm-hmm. Right. There is this new condition, so to speak, in health terms, where we are never truly cured, but where we can just manage. So we are continuously under observation, so to speak. And I have several clients of that nature, particularly also with HIV. That's a very good example that you just mentioned. It's kind of like just constantly on observation, but never really fully cured, but having a reasonable life expectancy with it. And sometimes also certain cancer outcomes can have the same result. So that is a new way of alertness for a person, to always be on alert. Like one really lives with the awareness that life is kind of a gift. Every day it's a gift. We can't take it for granted anymore. And that's different from everybody else then who just expects life, as Bob just has described. We just all have the sense that we all grow old.
There's also that fear, I suppose, that the other shoe will drop, right? That you're managing an illness, a chronic illness that is potentially very serious or even fatal. Maybe the rest of the world stops worrying about you, and you still have in the back of your mind the knowledge that at any point something could change.
Yes, you know, and there's for many people, they have chronic conditions of various kinds that require a lot of daily management on their own part, with medications, with treatments, and so on. That becomes integral to who they are and how they live their lives.
So we want people to make good choices about their health, right? If they have the option to eat healthfully and exercise and get regular medical care, we want them to do that. On the other hand, people who get sick feel lousy and deserve compassion. And I've seen reports even from within the medical community that sometimes people who have diseases that are believed to be attributable to lifestyle causes don't get the same kind of care. Are you aware of movements within the healthcare community in particular to sort of pay attention to this tendency we might have to stigmatize particular diseases?
Well, there's a lot of attention paid to stigmatization, and the conditions that can be can produce stigmas. I was really amazed in getting ready for today, looking up, well, disease and stigma. And it was like, my God, I couldn't complete the list.
Hmm.
Because there's just so many kinds of conditions that can lead to someone being stigmatized. And what we mean by that is they're not treated quite as fully human. So it could be anything from certain forms of cancer to obesity or AIDS, HIV/AIDS, of course, but even PTSD.
Mental illness,
Probably mental illness,
right,
more than anything else.
Has certainly had the most prominent history in terms of efforts to work against stigma. This whole anti-psychiatry movement, Thomas Sasse and some other British psychiatrists promoting humanizing schizophrenia. It's a little bit like a forerunner for today's movements in culture and minority studies, where we do not think of people with different abilities as handicapped anymore, but we think of them as differently abled and even have changed the language. And that helps empower these people in order to take recourse to the abilities that they do have and develop those better. And it really changes. It's not just verbiage. It's not just, you know, semantics. It really changes authentically how people feel about themselves if they don't have to feel stigmatized. but can accept that they are just different in their abilities. And sometimes also illnesses, like certain mental illnesses, fall in that category.
Some of the diseases that we stigmatize today are disproportionately associated with people who are poor. And it's interesting to me that we look not only, you know, we look at their personal responsibility and whatever contribution they may have made. We don't so much look at what society has an obligation to provide in terms of decent housing and education and income, that sort of thing. I guess there's a long history of marginalizing poor people who have the same diseases that might, in fact, affect wealthier people.
Right. If you there's a vicious cycle between poverty and illness, mm-hmm. that if you are, and despite your best efforts, if you come from a community that is deprived in terms of good housing, good sanitation, good food, good health care, that you're more likely to get sick no matter what you do. And, you know, again, with our strong emphasis on individuality, we kind of neglect the other factors that contribute to someone getting ill. I read that something like 50% of the communicable diseases are concentrated in the poorest 20% of the population, which is worldwide. The World Health Organization has good numbers on this, and that the lower your income, the more likely you are to be sick, to have your children die young, and to have lower life expectations. So it's not simply individual effort counts, of course, but there are also these social factors that, you know, that demand more collective action.
The Ebola outbreak in Guinea and Sierra Leone and Liberia has raised so many interesting questions and issues, one of which is the fact that Americans were not talking a lot about this until the first American doctor was reported to have been infected. He happened to have been a white doctor. And I wonder, again, if as a society, it's somehow comforting to us to imagine that is something that can't happen to us, that it's a problem that exists elsewhere, rather than thinking this is a virus that could, you know, potentially go anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as soon as we feel affected, of course, we'll be much more attentive and responding. And that is just, there seems to be a critical mass of what media information people can absorb on a daily basis. There's been a lot of studies and interviews and surveys about that, that when it's far away and we don't have to deal with it, we tend to not want to pay or help or reach out in any way. When it is one individual in a sensationalized case, this one pet dog or whatever that we can read about that comes to our doorstep, that's when we are reaching out to help. So there's some very unique psychological processes, how humans in groups, in societies operate.
Yeah, in addition to that, what we saw with the tendency on the part of many people to panic with the possibility of another Ebola case, you know, neglects the fact that as serious as it is and it's something that needs to be addressed, that there are a lot more, there are other diseases, other things that are more likely to kill us mm-hmm. than Ebola. You know, I remember thinking that, well, if you want to stay healthy, stay out of your car.
Yeah, exactly. You're more likely to have a fatal accident driving to work or whatever. Mm-hmm. We have an email here from Jeff who says, could you further discuss invisible illnesses and perceptions about those who are suffering, particularly younger individuals who have diseases that we can't see walking down the street but might significantly affect their lives?
Yeah. My experience with that is with talking with people that have chronic pain of various kinds. And part of their difficulty, part of their situation was the fact that they looked healthy. And in many respects, they were healthy, but still in all, they had this condition for whatever causes. Usually it was people that I spoke with was work-related, but nobody could see it. So pain, anyway, is subjective. It's a subjective phenomenon. You can't take your temperature and find out your pain level. it's something that you can it's very real to the individual, but to other people, it can be easily discounted. So that was my experience with the invisible disease and the tendency on the part of some to discount the pain of others because it doesn't show, and the tests all came back positive. You're all better. So why aren't you better now?
Right. And again, we have a moral concern and a practical concern about people becoming addicted, so that some people who are, I've heard stories of people who are, at least in the past, have been close to death, and there's been reluctance to provide, pain medication for fear of getting someone like addicted to morphine, which seems like a disordered way to think about the way we care for people.
Yeah, there's been a lot of attention paid to the fact that we tend to under-medicate people that are in serious pain, especially those that are at the end of life. We're more afraid of these substances. There's a history to that, but rather than concern for the relieving the suffering of somebody who can have their suffering relieved.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email us at think@kera.org. Joey in Denton says, my 50-year-old mother suffered a second heart attack last October and that's had vast changes on the lives of all family members. How does one balance the stigma of treating her like a Fabergé egg, but still give her a thoughtful push toward enjoying and engaging in life? Any thoughts on that, how to sort of help someone who maybe is fragile but also can engage?
Well, in the psychotherapeutic communities, we always deal with this dilemma of how to encourage a person to try to do the best they can with their abilities, while at the same time not blaming that they should be taking care of themselves. So that is a tight rope to walk, and it's very difficult for family members of somebody who has a condition, like a heart condition, how to encourage the person, but how not to blame.
Let me jump in. Excuse me for interrupting. We're going to take a quick break. I want you to be able to finish that thought. We're speaking with psychologist Dr. Angelica Tratter and Dr. Robert Kugelman from the University of Dallas. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about the psychology of illness and how communities respond to different kinds of diseases with two psychologists from the University of Dallas, Dr. Robert Kugelman and Dr. Angelica Tratter. And Angelica, you were speaking before the break about the fact that it's hard when you have a loved one who is in delicate health but maybe needs a little push to get back out there and enjoy what life they can, even with some limitations.
Right, and the real difference is just in the care, in the level of care. I can tell somebody and help somebody, encourage them to take some action if I do this with a caring gesture. But if I get impatient over time, and that's the challenge for family members when they have a lot to help, that they can get impatient over time. And of course, a patient will immediately sense, feel, hear that difference. And so that it's very, very important that helpers also seek help, that they get their support communities, either among friends, in the church, colleagues, family members, whatever.
Of course, we all have, met that person in our lives that for whatever reason, we try to be as empathetic as we can, and it feels as if they have a complaint at any moment, and whatever they're concerned about seems to us not to be valid. Is there a way to kind of understand people who seem to, in the absence of an illness that appears to really limit their function, who seem to kind of embrace that identity of being someone who is helpless and needs a lot of help and ill all the time.
Yeah, that's, you know, this is a really important topic. I mean, it has to do with the fact that seeing yourself as a victim can be a way that someone carves out an identity.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be really difficult. I mean, the sociologists talk about sick roll, that if you call in sick, you can get away from your obligations for a while. Although after a bit, you have some obligations of your own to try to get well. And I think someone who has embraced that kind of victim position, maybe the clinician can address this as well, but I think there's a kind of passivity that can become a way to deal with maybe situations in which they feel powerless or not appreciated. So, you know, a negative identity is better than no identity at all.
Hmm. Right. It's like children sometimes prefer to get a negative response from parents rather than no response.
Yeah.
But
mm-hmm.
back to the victim position, yes, this is actually a very protracted thing. And often therapists get blamed even for colluding in the victimizations of their clients if they cannot get better anytime soon. And it's a very, very difficult thing, very difficult process. Usually, diagnostically speaking, we find a little bit of personality style that feeds into that, a dependent personality style that thrives on victimization, on self-victimization. But then there are also people who just really have been thrown at dished out all the bad cards that you could possibly get, and very serious, legitimate situation of early childhood chronic trauma where it's just not possible to leave that behind in any easy way without substantial help. And so there to talk there about self-victimization or taking on the victim role would again be a blame game.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very, 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 very complicated in the domain of illnesses, physical and mental illnesses. And that just reminds me back about the question of the invisible illnesses that one of your listeners had asked. We could really think of there being two kinds of invisible illnesses. The ones where, you know, that we usually think about where we don't see anything in terms of we don't see any symptoms. But there are also another type of invisible illnesses there where we don't see the causes. We may see symptoms like, you know, classic psychosomatic illnesses. They can be very distressing for individuals running around with, you know, irritable bowel syndrome, this, that, or whatever else, and having no clue what brings that on, let alone hysterical symptoms, any kind of physical, you know, breathing problems, panicky states or so, not having an idea what brings it on. That is very, very distressing. And that kind of invisibility is in a way even can be more distressing for the individual than the other one where we don't see symptoms.
If someone's child, say, you know, needs crutches or a leg brace or something to deal with an injury or illness, most people are really quick to try and accommodate that child. If someone says, my child has a severe peanut allergy, please set the table accordingly. There are some people who get really upset about that and assume that this is all made up. What do you have any thoughts on how people can best deal with those who don't believe that they have a problem that in fact does sort of significantly affect their lives?
Oh, wow. This is I know people that have celiac disease, which is an allergy to, well, I don't know if allergy is the correct word, but they can't take gluten.
A severe reaction.
Right. Severe reaction. And it can lead to death if it's not treated well. So that's a real condition that people have to deal with. But I think these things also become seen as a fast road to good health by everybody avoiding gluten or something. Mm-hmm. So I think maybe there can be a little bit of overreaction to the fact that these things become popular in the culture.
I think that there probably, statistically speaking, there aren't that many people left who are real kind of, you know, stubborn horses who just wouldn't want to budge and be accommodating to someone's special needs. I find that societally we are getting better and better with it. But if there are some folks left who just wouldn't understand, I just recommend that everybody around them really helps them understand and speaks out for those others who do need the help. Because it's important. It can, as you just said, it can be life-threatening.
Have we lost our ability to be comfortable around people who are sick because, at least in this country and culture, the moment someone is quite ill, we put them in a hospital, obviously to get them good care, but they're not really our responsibility in quite the same way anymore.
Yeah, that we've taken illness and death as well, and we've sequestered them away. And so it's not like I imagine in the old days when you would see the sick and people that had various disabilities just out on the street. It tends to become something that's more privatized, and that does make it difficult, I think, when one is faced with the condition oneself, because you get ill or you get a serious injury or something, and you can find yourself isolated and cut off, and that can be very discouraging to people.
Yes, and on the one hand, we send people to the hospitals. On the other hand, we also have these institutional limitations here where nobody is kept in a hospital anymore past just the actual procedure and the necessary, you know, 2-3 convalescent days or so. And afterwards, people are sent home. So again, you know, against our fears or better knowledge, we end up having to take care of our folks because the institutions won't keep them anymore. And so everybody does have to learn what it means to tend to an ill person. And so that has become quite unavoidable, particularly also with the cutting costs in the medical system.
Yeah, and a lot of people when they get elderly and they're sick and they don't see any prospect of them improving, I think many of us want to avoid institutions. You know, we want to be comfortable at home as long as possible, to be independent at home as long as possible, and that's part of what's going on.
And not having to go to a nursing home, if not absolutely necessary. Yes, most everybody really would prefer to just stay among their loved ones.
Mm-hmm. For diseases that are stigmatized, that we associate with behaviors that we can control, does the stigma help to keep people doing the right thing? Does it make a difference? Does the stigma against obesity, for example, help people to lose weight?
Paradoxically, it does the opposite,
yes,
in my experience. What do you think?
I would think so, because it has, if people are treating you as less than a full human being, that's not encouraging you to do anything good for yourself. You tend to, I think it's a strong tendency to take on the lowered expectations, damaged identity that you may get from the stigma. So I think an individual who's stigmatized has to really fight that or counter it in some way if they can.
Right. So Bob comes at it from the health studies field and I from psychotherapy, and we probably can join heads there right there that indeed it creates a very disturbing psychological cycle in the sense that I'm already frustrated if I'm heavily overweight, right? And if in addition I'll get a judgment, a societal judgment that I feel upon myself, then of course it's like the depression about the depression. I'm getting depressed about being depressed. I'm getting upset about being upset. And it's then this real vicious cycle out of which it's much, much more difficult to mobilize positive motivation to actually do productively change my lifestyle.
Is mental health care something that is starting to be part of the standard regimen for people who are coping with catastrophic illnesses? Is that sort of thrown into the list of different treatments that someone might be given?
It can be. I mean, there has been this development since the 1970s of health psychology, which deals with the non-mental illnesses that, mm-hmm. that we can suffer. And some people that do health psychology are clinical health psychologists, so they would be involved in psychological care of people with chronic, especially, you know, chronic diseases like cancer or heart disease. But like everything else, it's expensive. And so I think that limits its availability. One of the things that, you know, coming back to stigma just for a second, mm-hmm. is the fact that there are sometimes you find groups of people banding together to fight the stigma. Either it's something that's done officially with some of the mental health organizations or with support groups, or some of the more there's a group that publishes a magazine called Hearing Voices. And it's for people with that hear voices, but they're not seeing themselves as ill necessarily or something that should be stigmatized, but as they're asserting themselves as full human beings.
Right. Language makes a great difference. But it's also intriguing to look at it in the sense of, you know, I always talk about or think about the whole bandwidth of the stigma of the label on the one hand, where some people just don't like to have a diagnostic label, particularly in the mental health field, and all the way to the other side of the polarity, the torture of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. So where are you in that whole bandwidth, right? If one has absolutely no idea what's going on with oneself, you know, visiting or shopping around with doctors and everybody says something different, that's torture. A lot of people, they really have a hard time coping with that. Or parents, if they can't find what's wrong with their child, everybody's complaining, teachers, school counselors, and so forth. One doesn't quite have a definite quote-unquote diagnosis, mm-hmm. right? So that can be quite torturous. But on the other hand, the diagnosis is also often then a stigmatizing label. So that's where we move in this whole continuum, and different people are served with different outcomes. Some people like a label. It makes them feel calm, and others, they really don't want to deal with it and go to the Hearing Voices group, right?
Amen.
Got to jump in there. Dr. Right. Angelica Tratter is an adjunct professor of psychology at the University of Dallas. Dr. Robert Kugelman is professor of psychology at the University of Dallas. Bob and Angelica, thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones from Marshall Noor. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day. We'll be right back.